Hey there, conductors. If you've ever felt that you're not quite sure what to do next when you're studying a score, maybe you don't even know where to start with a difficult piece, maybe you study one piece too much and then you realize at the first rehearsal that you don't know another one well enough, or maybe you're a new conductor and you don't know what score study is, I'm excited to share that I'm finally publishing and sharing my score study checklist. I've been refining this for 12 years now, and I'm so excited to share it. It is going to walk you through my structure, my process to make sure that I learn every score that I need to learn well enough and so that nothing falls through the cracks. So it covers everything that you need to know. There's a link in the show notes. Go ahead and click it, sign up, and you'll get that score study checklist sent right to your email. You'll also get access to an 8-minute video of me explaining what each section is and how I use it to organize all the music that I need to learn. It's only 8 minutes, so it's not going to take you a whole hour to learn how to study better, how to put up a process for your score study, and how to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks. So again, click the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you soon. Now, please enjoy this episode of Podium Time. Welcome to Podium Time, the podcast for conductors and students. Hello, and welcome to this special episode of Podium Time. I'm your host, Jeremy D. Quabus, and I recently finished taking the Make Beautiful Music class with Markhand Thacker. So today's episode is actually a review slash summary of what I learned in that class. I'm going to be teaching it to Luke today. Now, this video was originally created for our assistant conductor patrons over on Patreon, so there's one visual example and a couple of other small things that might not make sense because this is originally for video, but all the good stuff is still there, so I wouldn't post this if it weren't still awesome for audio. Basically, I really highly recommend that you take Markhand's class if you have any interest in becoming a better musician or conductor. The next session is starting at the beginning of October, so head over and sign up. Space is pretty limited, but I talked to Markhand today, and they still have a couple spots open, so hurry up and check that out. Their website is thebco.org. That's thebco.org. Again, this class has totally changed how I learn, study, and even listen to music in only just a couple of weeks. So definitely check it out and get those spots before they're filled. I accidentally got the very last spot for the first session, and I'm really glad I was able to get in there at the last minute. I'd also like to share an exciting documentary that's premiering right now and for this week only called The Bowmakers. It's only available from September 12th to 20th, 2020, and The Bowmakers is an exploration of the creativity and craftsmanship that goes into making the world's finest violin, viola, and cello bows. It follows the journey all the way from the Amazon jungle to the heart of France and ending in a small town in Washington State, where you can actually find 5 of the top bow makers in the world in this small coastal town. The tickets are available at osscs.org, and proceeds go to benefit Orchestra Seattle. So check that documentary out while you can. Links for that and everything else are going to be in the show notes on our website or in your podcast player. So now prepare yourself for the rare Jeremy Luke chat episode. We've not done these in a while, but this one definitely has more structure than we used to. We used to kind of go off the cuff, but I actually practiced this one before we did it. And you'll get the special treat of me singing Lightly Row in a couple different ways. So please head over to patreon.com/podiumtimepod. You can see the full video version. There's a little bit of extra discussion at the end that's not in this audio version. And on our Patreon, you can learn how to support the podcast, get more awesome discussions like this, get some score analyses. We're still building up a little library of content there. But for now, please enjoy this summary slash review of the Make Beautiful Music online course. So we're going to be talking through Markhand Thacker's Make Beautiful Music class, which I just finished. Overall, it was pretty awesome. I learned a whole lot. So, and I'm just going to go through what we learned in the class, then a lot of the practical things that I took out of it. So if you haven't read Markhand's books or if you haven't been to one of his workshops, basically his philosophy of music is that, you know, when you get lost in something, you totally forget that you're doing it, like the flow state, or when you lose yourself in a piece of art, whether that's a movie or a book or whatever, and you kind of wake up on the other side. His philosophy is that we can achieve this
in music, by we can have this transcendent experience where we transcend our us as the subject plus the art as the object. We can lose ourselves in it. And
is that like losing yourself as a conductor or as a listener?
Good question. As the idea is that the listener can lose themselves, the audience can lose themselves. And so
I was
going to
say, when you start losing yourself in a performance,
well,
that's
I think
when things get a little scary.
I think we do it as well when everything's just going right, everything's going so smooth, and you know everything's just happening. Or like when you're driving and you kind of just like wake up on the at your destination. So the idea is not wake up at your destination.
That's
but you're like,
not
oh,
how
wow.
you're supposed to drive.
So the idea is that we can help. We can make sure that all the ultimate is that all musical experiences, every experience we give the audience, is one of the can be transcendent. And so his philosophy of music is, what is it that we can do to allow that to happen? What is it that we can do to help audiences do that? And it basically all boils down to how I interpreted it and how I took it was, he talks a lot about energy, which we'll get into in a second, but the whole idea is also to not break your concentration, not have anything that knocks you out of the flow of the moment. And there are a bunch of things that can knock you out of the flow, like bad intonation can knock you out because you remember that brings your mind to a technical thing. And so, you know, you're thinking about an intellectual aspect of the music, or, you know, if a retard is just like way too much, it can take you out of the music because you lose the flow of the music and it brings too much attention to itself. So these kind of things, we want to avoid those things. And then we also want to create beauty in what we're doing. So
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Okay. So like, what is a piece for you that you've had this experience on, and then you went back to listen to like a different recording, and all of a sudden it was just gone? Like, you know, have you ever had that happen? Like for me, when I listen to Death and Transfiguration, if certain things don't happen a specific way, then for some reason I get really focused on what didn't happen how I expected it to. And then there are some times where I don't know if it's how I just the perfect way that I hear, like this is exactly how I want to hear it or what, but then sometimes I'll listen to it and like this is I transcend the music or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and I really get lost in what's going on. And I've always just found it very fascinating that the same music by the same composer with the same notes but simply performed by a different group can literally alter how you feel about that music.
Okay.
And I've always wondered like this exact question, like how can we do this every time? So I always just assumed that it was specific to each individual person, because a lot of times when you get lost in something, it's because it's triggering a memory or something that like you connect with on some kind of emotional level, you know.
And your mental space when you're listening has a big effect on whether that's possible. If you're distracted by something else, that may not happen. Or what I've picked up is that the more trained you are as a musician, the less likely it is to happen, because there are more things that we think about, and our threshold for mistakes is a lot bigger. You know, we notice mistakes that the audience, that a regular audience won't notice. So it's right. Actually a little harder for us, I think, to get into that space, because again, anytime you move it into an intellectual where you're thinking about something specific, or you know, even if something's so beautiful that it's like, oh my God, that clarinet line was so gorgeous, even that is kind of bringing you out for a second. So that's a whole other discussion of that experience that we don't cover as much because we don't really have any control over it. But the things we do control are the flow of the music and how we prepare it. Did you have anything else before we get in more to that? I do think we should talk about this maybe at a different time, because we can go plenty into that.
Okay, I am not going to interrupt you unless I have something really good.
Please do interrupt. I just want to I want to bookmark that discussion for later.
Okay.
So, let's see. Looking at my notes. And so part of that philosophy is, again, how can we achieve this? The things we do have control over are the flow of the music. So how can we make the optimal opportunity for that to happen? Each piece has a range of interpretations that are appropriate to it. Each situation has a range. There's no one answer, but there are plenty of wrong answers. There are plenty of things that can knock you out. And so a lot of his philosophy, and we talked about this in the interview with him a couple months ago, is also that, it's not that you're creating an interpretation of the piece, but that there is an optimal interpretation inherent in the piece, which is a very different way to look at it. The composer's tools, not computer tool, yes, tools yet. So basically everything is, a building and decaying of energy, anything. And this is energy in consciousness. You know, if you hear a sound, even after that sound is gone, it still remains in your consciousness for a little bit. One way to think of this is, if my name is Jeremy, that third syllable, the me, has meaning on its own, but when the Jera comes before it, the Jera is over by the time you get to the me, but because it all happens in one conscious moment, you put them together. If you stretch it out like Jera, me, that could be finishing my name or it could be a different idea. So the goal is to create whole sections and whole movements that create this one act of consciousness where nothing's broken out and everything happens in once and you get lost in it. And we do that with energy, both on a small scale and on a large scale. And what I've found is that a lot of the things we inherently feel as good musicianship is just a function of energy. It explains so much. So let's see. Just to explain on the short scale, I actually have an example. Let's see. I'm going to screen share. So, Scoopadoo, can you see that okay?
Yes.
So this is Lightly Row.
Oh, I don't know that one.
So this is an example that I stole. I scanned this out of Mark Henn's conducting book, his most recent book. So here's a quick look at the scale of energy for this. It's a little scary. But we're gonna break this down, because one of the most practical things that immediately helped me is just looking at this. So first, if we look at this first basic scale of energy, the idea is that anytime something musical happens, it creates energy or it decays energy. So this ba-dun-dun, we kind of naturally come back at that because there's a creation, and then for a number of reasons, but mostly right here at the lower notes, it kind of relaxes. So right here we have ba-dun-dun, dee-dum-dum. And then we'll skip this for a second again here. So there are these little microscopic moments where an energy is created and falls. Here you could do another. You could do a creation of energy here that falls off. And that's where we get in the second layer. So in the second layer, you can combine these two. And then here again. So there's a bunch of layers. We don't notate each one of these, but doing these on a small tune a couple times is a really good exercise to start getting this understanding. And then if we go more, we see that there are even larger sections. So if you look at the first four measures, there's a whole section leading up to this measure three. So these two decay, but they're all in the service of moving towards this beat right here. You can see my mouse, can't you?
Yeah.
Okay. And then dee-dum-dum, dee-dum-dum, da-da-dum-dum-dum. And so the idea is that in a good performance, we come up to here and then come down to here. The two tools that we have as performers are basically rhythmic density and dynamics. So through volume and through tempo, we can adjust this If we keep going, dun 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 dun. And then the ultimate idea is that each unit, each piece has an ideal climax. That's the highest point, and then everything leads to that, and then comes back down. And I think this is a really good one, and it even, we have a moment where at the end, since this comes so close to the end, we've got a little bit more energy, so we have to do a little retard here. So if we look at all of Lightly Row, we have da-dum-dum, dee-dum-dum, da-da-da-da-dum-dum-dum, dee-dum-dum, dee-dum-dum, da-da-dum-dum-dum. Dum 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 team. Dum 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 team. Dee dum dum dee dum dum. Da da dum dum dum. And part of the reason why we feel a retard that we really feel we need to do is because we have a little bit more energy left over, or we want to make a big piece, big part, more dramatic. So in the small scale, that's kind of the way this energy works. Any questions?
Nope, but when you were singing, it, like, for a moment took me back to Maestro Farberman and his comment of, like, has anyone ever told you you have a beautiful voice?
No.
You should consider you becoming a singer instead of a conductor.
I'm glad you kept with it, because you'd only been conducting for, like, what, a year, a couple months at that point?
Yeah, we had that one semester with Celts.
Yeah, just a couple months. Oof, good times.
That was so scary.
Yeah, so you can use this building of energy in that micro, in that, like, da-dum-dum, to explain why if we do something and then we pull back, you know, kind of like maybe in a waltz, bum 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 bum, right? The second and third beats or less in the really small scale. This really helps with building larger phrases. It really helped me connect, and even through whole sections in the large scale of a piece, we have there's rhythmic and large scale harmonic energy, and we went into a lot of that, a lot of how composers create large scale harmonic energy, which is really the way that you keep that energy going over the long scale. So, like, sonata form is, you know, first theme, as you move into the dominant, there's a creation of energy. The climax usually happens somewhere in the development, which then relaxes into the first theme again, relaxes into the second theme, now in the home key, so there's less tension there. And then maybe a little coda, a little bump at the end. So again, we learned all the concepts, and then we did the second half of the class is performance critiques. And so basically, we took a couple specific recordings from YouTube that Markant found particularly offensive in one way or another, and then we just listened and found every little thing that we could fix, as if we were rehearsing it and this is what the orchestra was giving us. So that kind of it wasn't just like what's wrong with this, but like how could we make this incredible. He's got a metaphor that he likes, that music is not like basketball, unfortunately. Like in basketball, if you shoot a hoop, it either gets in or it doesn't. But in music, in a performance, you can play the music, and even if it's not absolutely incredible, it's still pretty good. Like, no one's going to complain about it. But we can always make it better. We can always reach that higher beauty with more phrasing and more whateverness. You know, interpretation, if you want to call it that.
Finesse.
Yeah. One of the quotes I wrote down was, and a lot of his philosophy is also that there's an inherent structure that's in the music. Like with Lightly Row, you know, the composer didn't sit down and write those dynamics down, but you can figure them out. And so one of the quotes I wrote down from him is, only following exactly what is in the score is an excuse for poor musicianship. If you're only playing what's written in the score and dynamics, and you're not doing what's implied by the shape of the music, then that's just an excuse for not wanting to do anything or not caring. So again, we just learned about the philosophy, and then we did some performance critiques of some big name conductors, and we just took a 2-hour class listening through sections of it and talking like, this is, you know, this is what could be improved. This is what's good. This is what we could do with it. You know, is this beautiful? Why not? What could we do about it? So that was really, really helpful. Now I wanted to just go over what I learned practically, like what I've taken from this class right away that I can attribute. And I've got Mark Ehn's book, so I'm going to keep reading because there's a lot more depth to his and a lot, this is a lifetime of learning and a whole new way of seeing music. But these are just some of the practical lessons that I learned over the 12-week class. We just practiced listening a lot. Again, with those performance critiques, we would get this great performance and then practice listening through every measure and just hearing what was actually happening in the music and, you know, hearing balances and all that stuff. There's a big discussion about tempo, and, you know, as conductors, tempo is always important for us, but Mark Ehn has a very good way of explaining tempo and how it works, and that every piece has, again, a range of good tempos and then a plenty of range of bad tempos. So there's no one right tempo. Again, a lot of this creating the most beautiful experience depends on our perception of it. So as an audience member, the tempo that you figure out in your practice room won't be exactly perfect because what's happening in the hall is different. There's a different amount of information coming into your ears and into your consciousness. So in a really boomy, reverberative hall with a big, big, big orchestra, your tempos are going to have to be slower because there's just more information coming at your ears. But in a really small hall, with a tiny Mozart orchestra, you can play things much faster because there's not as much waves in the air. There's not as much for you to mentally process. So you can hear those notes faster. The difference between speed and tempo, speed is like the objective. We're at 80 beats per minute. Tempo is more of a perceived thing. So, if you think of riding your bike 30 miles an hour down a hill versus driving 60 miles an hour on the highway, you're driving twice as fast. But riding a bike 30 miles down an hour down a hill feels way damn faster.
Yeah.
So that's that difference. You can have a tiny Mozart orchestra playing really, really fast, but it doesn't sound too fast. But if you have a big Wagner orchestra in a big boomy hall trying to play that same piece at that same tempo, it's going to feel like it's way too fast. Like there's too much muddle. You can't hear anything. And part of the reason that Beethoven's tempo marks, Mark Ehn says, are too fast for a lot of, you know, his marks are fast, is that, a lot of times he did all the metronome marks after he'd gone deaf. So a lot of them he was playing or figuring out when he couldn't actually hear very well. And so he wasn't getting the acoustical input on his brain. You can hear things in your mind much faster than your ear can actually hear it and process it into your brain. So that's one theory.
You also have to think about the fact that he did a lot of his composing at the piano, and he probably was able to play everything he was writing. Mm-hmm. And a pianist can play a hell of a lot faster than an entire orchestra can play. Mm-hmm. And so something that may have sounded good to him on the piano might not have translated to the orchestra.
Yeah.
Now, I would argue that Beethoven would know better than that. It's Beethoven we're talking about. No, I watched this. I think I told you about it. That video online that talked about the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata and how the tempo markings don't line up. And I think, if I remember correctly, he said that Beethoven, in his research, he found that Beethoven used a different system of a metronome. It was I'll find the video and post a link to it because it's really fascinating. Yeah. The entire discussion is really fascinating. But no, I think, and sometimes I really notice that when a piece isn't working for me, as far as like transcending me somewhere amazing, mm-hmm. you know, I think a lot of the time that happens because the orchestra is playing too fast and there's not enough. I think the idea of tension is so important. And I really think that should guide our speed, our tempo, and instead of being so rigid on a metronome marking. Mm-hmm. Because you could put a piece of music into a MIDI and have it play the perfect tempo the whole time. And not only will every note be perfect and every dynamic will be perfect, but it will be the perfect speed and you will not feel a thing. Mm-hmm. Because it's not natural. Music is like conversation, and if you play and perform your music as if you are literally verbalizing a story, you start to make music. I really figured out like how incredible tension is in music by I think it's Schmidt Symphony Number 4. And it opens with just a solo trumpet by itself playing this gorgeous line. And then all of a sudden the orchestra starts to come in, but it's not just entering without meaning. The timpani comes in with just a very, very soft boom, boom, boom. And so automatically we start moving somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you know you're going somewhere, and you know that typically you don't have to wait very long to know where you're going. But instead of giving us this satisfaction of a resolution, he just increases the instrumentation, increases the dynamics, but at the same time, things start to slow down. Mm. In the recording that I heard the first time, you know, because this was one of those moments for me where I was completely transfixed by this music. I was driving to Sedalia for a symphony rehearsal, and I stumbled across it. And the whole way there, I was just sobbing. It was beautiful. But like that feeling of, I know I want to get somewhere. We've been at this a while. Come on, let's figure out what we're doing. Like you start to almost get impatient, and then the speed starts to slow down. Mm-hmm. And you start to really, like your ear really starts to dig in, like, all right, something is gonna happen. And the volume gets louder, everything gets bigger, but the tempo just gets even slower all the way up until boom, resolution. And then the entire orchestra is just gone. And you're just left with a pair of wings. Mm-hmm. And then he starts it up immediately. Boom. Like four measures later, he's got the timpani back. And we start building again. And the entire piece is just this constant stretching.
Release of energy. Of the,
yes. And the thing, the amount of energy that he's able to get. I need to figure out who the conductor was and what orchestra it was, but the amount of energy that this conductor and orchestra are able to build through their dynamics and through their, you know, stretching of time and meter. It's just unbelievable. And if you can listen to that whole symphony and not just wind up in tears, I don't know if you're human. You know, and so like just hear, like even looking at your graph, you know, the graphs that he had that you were showing me, like I automatically start thinking like, oh, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like I said, a lot of the things we feel inherently, like this energy idea really explains why we feel it. Like even just coming to the end of a phrase, we come to the end of the phrase and we feel a retard, like we do, because we've got just a little bit too much energy and we just want to settle for a second and let just a little bit more play out. Or at the end of the piece, if it's big and big and big, and you know, that last chord hits, and then you just kind of know when it's over. Like that's kind of when the energy in your consciousness has let it go. You know, if it's a short chord, jump. And then a couple seconds later, you're like, okay, now it's Now it's done. And then that's when you put your hands down. And so that's this I'm finding more and more and more that this really explains that every tempo fluctuation, every little phrasing just makes so much sense because of this energy in the small and the large scale.
Well, I think another good example of this building of energy and, you know, how tempo affects, you know, how you perceive it is Sibelius II. From the transition from the third movement to the fourth movement, you know, that is always something that if it's taken too fast, I don't feel a thing. If anything, I get frustrated because I know how incredible that resolution feels into the fourth movement when you really, truly take your time getting there. And I know you're not supposed to go super slow, but there's so much happening texturally in there that if you're going too fast, you miss all of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is so easily ruined if we rush it.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on from tempo, I have to give Merkin's tagline that the correct tempo is one in which you can hear all the notes all the time. Meaning it's not too fast, such that you lose any notes, and it's not too slow, such that you can't keep a phrase. So if the energy dies before you continue, then the phrase just, it's over. It doesn't connect the different sections.
Right.
Yeah. The other big thing that came in that, again, practically as a conductor, is I never really knew how to hear I knew how to hear balances, but I never really knew what it should be or what to listen for. And so if you just think of two voices, let's say it's a violin and a cello playing the same note or playing one note an octave apart, the best balance between those two voices is one in which you hear them as a unit and not as a cello and a violin. So when you're balancing, you want to start with the high voice and then bring the low voice to the point where it's supporting it. Because if the low voice is too loud, you lose the top voice. But the top voice can never be so loud that you actually lose the bottom voice. You know, if the violin can never play so loud that you can't hear the cello, but the cello can very easily play so loud that you can't hear the violin. So if I went over to the piano, and I'm so glad I did this, it's one of the examples from his book, but just to play two notes an octave apart and practice playing the low voice a little higher, the low voice a little louder, and the high voice a little louder, or play one note and sing into it, and find that spot where they click in, where they become one sound instead of a high voice and your own voice. It's a really magical moment to hear, and I wish that the sound on Zoom were good enough to demonstrate it. But a lot of balance issues are just you're losing the upper voices. Like we listen to the Debussy Faun, and there's a low chord, but the whole orchestra is in it. And in the recording we listen to, you can only hear the basses and cellos. You just totally lose the seconds and violas. And so their voices are now not participating in the music that we're trying to create. So those low voices need to be a little bit less. The high voices need to be a little bit more. That's the general rule, is usually high voices need to be louder.
Well, and you also have to think about the fact that you always want the instruments to equally be heard, because sometimes the composer is writing two instruments together because they want that specific sound. And I think Tchaikovsky did this a lot, where he would write like oboe and the, you know, clarinet together. And it's such a bizarre sound because you have that harsh sound of the oboe with that really smooth, you know, sound of the clarinet that comes together. And it almost sounds like a different instrument. But in reality, it's, you know, just these two instruments playing so well together that it sounds like one instrument, you know, just like you said.
Yeah, and again,
when it comes to like tuning,
go ahead.
Well, I don't know if you've ever heard of this. When I was in band, Dr. Prather would always teach her banjiers, you know, when they would tune the orchestra, right? When they would tune the band, she would always tell them that, you know, what you listen for is waves. Because if if you hear a wave, it means that they aren't all playing on the same frequency. They aren't playing the same notes. You know, they aren't playing the same chord. One of them is wrong, right? So you want to figure out which one needs to be adjusted so that when you hear that music, you're not hearing this.
Yeah, and you don't want anything to take you out of it.
Yeah, and at first I didn't notice the difference between this note over here or this note over here. But now, you know, after listening to a lot of music over the years, you know, and been in a lot of rehearsals since then, you know, that's something I always notice. And it's something I always think about when an orchestra tunes or a band tunes and I hear this and then they just start playing and it's like, but do you really know what they sound like? You know, are they really in tune or are you just doing this as a formality?
Yeah.
You know, that I don't know how well that would work with like the, you know, string instruments as far as that, if that would still apply. I'm not a sound engineer, so.
Yeah. One more note on phrasing. I want to move towards the end because somebody's going to be walking in my door in a couple minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. taking up your podcast.
I'm sorry. No, sorry, not phrasing. Balance. When you balance, you want to start with the soft instrument and move the hard instrument into it. So with the clarinet and oboe, the oboe is going to have an easier job overpowering the clarinet because it's a lot harsher sound. So you would want to start with the clarinet and then move the oboe into it. So that's just the last note on balance. Really, go sit at the piano and play the higher note louder until you can get them just together. It's really fascinating. The last two points are just that this class really, really, really helped me with phrasing in the small and the large scale, like conducting a piece and combining the larger sections into it. Just like seeing how the first theme and the second theme are both building. And if you listen for that, it is there. And you'll hear recordings where they slow down in the second theme. And sometimes it works, but sometimes it's like, okay, well, now we're not building energy like we should be. Like, slow down in the second theme the second time when, on the larger scale, things are releasing. This has been given me a really new starting place for my score study and really helped me, again, connect the exposition, connect all the things in the exposition. Like, oh, we're building here, and we're building here, and we go to here, and we come down a little bit, but then we go even more, and blah, blah, blah. This has given me a tool to mix whole movements together. And to start to get the idea of a whole movement in my head, because of this understanding of this arc of energy. So there's that overarching arc for the whole movement, and then there are a bunch of little ones at different levels below it. So I really recommend this class highly. We're going to be sharing this. Another run is going in the next couple of weeks. It's a 12-week class. It's fantastic. It's very cheap. I think it's $330 for the 12 weeks, which for an online course, 2 hours a week with a teacher is awesome. And there's 2 hours of office hours, so you can go and ask them anything else. And I took advantage of those. We had a couple extra conversations, and I'm really glad I did. Do you have anything else to talk about? We can talk till Chrisera gets home, and then we can cut it off.
Oh, I'm just thinking this was a lot of fun, and we should do a lot more of these.
I like these. It's
just
almost like a book report.
About music.
Yeah, yeah. I would love to do more of these on the podcast. It's been a while, but this was fun. I learned so much. I'm so glad. I actually just kind of got in. I was the last spot, and I just happened to get in. I'm so glad I did because I'd been wanting to work with Marquand for a while. And I definitely like to do his workshop now. That's the next step.
Well, I'm going to send you the Schmidt.
Please do. I'd love to. I'm also having
really
so much more fun listening to music now. Like it almost feels like I know how to listen to music, and some music is more disappointing because I see where it doesn't really make sense or where it would make more musical sense, where it would be better in this way or that way. And also none of this is dogmatic. None of this is the answer. It's the questions. I asked Mark Henn the answer once, and I told him I didn't agree with him, and he said, I can't guarantee the answer is correct, but I can guarantee that these questions will get you somewhere. Like, that these are the right questions to be asking. So, I just wanted to say that. Hey there, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for this special episode of Podium Time. Again, you can learn more about the Make Beautiful Music class at thebco.org. Check out the Bowmakers documentary at osscs.org. And check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/podiumtimepod. Links for all of those in the show notes on our website, or just open your podcast player and you should be able to click them right from there. And actually, if you click the support link on the podcast player, that should take it to our Patreon as well. Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony was performed by the Czech National Symphony Orchestra, and Beethoven's Egmont Overture was performed by Stefano Ligorati.